Welcome to Switchblade Sisters, where women get together to slice and dice our favorite action and genre films. I'm April Wolf. Every week, I invite a new female filmmaker on, a writer, director, actor, or producer, and we talk in depth about one of their fave genre films, perhaps one that's influenced their own work in some small way. And today, I'm very excited to have writer-director Alexandra McGuinness here. Hi!
Hi, April. Thanks for having me.
For those of you who are less familiar with her work, please let me give you an introduction to Alexandra McGuinness. Alexandra is a writer and director born in Dublin, Ireland. She graduated from the London Film School in 2010. Her debut feature film, Lotus Eaters, about a group of young Londoners getting lost in a world of drugs, parties, and sex and frivolity, premiered at the Tribeca Film Festival in 2011. The film later showed at Mill Valley Film Festival, London Film Festival, and Galway Film Festival, among others, before being released theatrically by Path, Curzon, and Phase 4. She's since directed commercials, short films, and music videos. Variety also named her a director to watch, and she created, wrote, and directed the 2016 web series Writers for Super Deluxe. Now, Alexandra's second feature, She's Missing, stars Eiza Gonzalez, Lucy Fry, and Josh Hartnett. The film is about a rodeo queen who goes missing and her best friend who embarks on a search across the desert, uncovering secrets and violence along the way. Vertical released the film December 20th of last year, and now she's moved on to a script called Lucia, based on the life of James Joyce's daughter, produced by Savage Films. And then I'm assuming that we could probably see your last feature someplace.
She's Missing is at streaming Amazon, Apple, Vudu, everywhere that
okay.
you can kind of stream
Wonderful.
Films
And we'll give
moment.
People a reminder later on, too. But Alexandra, the movie that you chose to talk about today is called Bunny Lake is Missing, a personal favorite of mine, too. Can you give us a little explanation on why this one's one of your fave genre films?
I saw this movie probably 10, 15 years ago. I think at the time it wasn't available to see, and mm-hmm. I probably illegally downloaded it. but you can't even do that anymore. So. but I was looking at Otto Preminger's, like a lot of his films, and I love this film. It's really unusual. I think it was probably very modern for its time. It has wonderful performances, but also kind of these tangents that I think are really interesting. It sometimes goes into these moments of horror, but and it's a bit of a, it's like a kind of high budget B movie as well. And I think that I noticed the parallels to my movie, She's Missing, after the fact, not when I was making
okay.
it. Yeah. So I kind of recalled it again.
Yeah. Sometimes those things just kind of stick with you in your brain, and you're not really sure where some of your inspiration is coming from. But
yeah, I'm sure. I'm sure it was in my unconscious.
It's somewhere. For those of you who haven't seen Bunny Lake is Missing, today's episode will give you some spoilers, but that shouldn't stop you from listening before you watch. My motto, as always, is that it's not what happens, but how it happens that makes a movie worth watching. And still, if you would like to watch it now, take your chance. All right, now you're back. All right. Let's introduce Bunny Lake is Missing. Written by Penelope Mortimer and John Mortimer and directed by Otto Preminger, Bunny Lake is Missing stars Carol Lindley, RIP, who just passed last year,
yeah.
As Anne Lake, an American who's just arrived in London. While her house is being unpacked, she goes to the Little People's Garden School to pick up her 5-year-old daughter, Bunny. But Bunny is mysteriously disappeared.
How old is she?
She's a 4.
Oh, well, then, the 4s are all gone home ages ago, except those that stayed to dinner.
Will you all please stop saying that? The 4s are not all on their way home. Mine isn't, and she isn't at dinner either. We looked.
A woman remembers Anne, but doesn't remember seeing Bunny. So the school questions her as though she's lying until Anne's brother, Stephen, played by Cara Delevingne, arrives. Stephen searches through the schoolhouse and finds Ada Ford upstairs, an old woman who collects the children's nightmares on her tape recorder to write a book.
I'm writing a book, you know, on children's fantasies. Would you like a cigarette?
No, thank you.
I have all their little nightmares on my tape machine.
Things are getting weird. They call in Superintendent Newhouse, played by Laurence Olivier, and they go back to the lake house to inspect. At the house, all of Bunny's things are suddenly gone. Anne doesn't understand, but Newhouse thinks Bunny maybe never existed at all. Newhouse takes Anne to a pub to get a sense if she's got her wits about her or not. He tries to question her.
I just want to find one simple thing. One small, simple proof.
Proof of what?
That Bunny Lake exists.
But Anne protests, though her wits are certainly crumbling under the weight of some brandy. On the way home, actually at home, she's like visiting her brother in the bath when she remembers, as you do, when she remembers she's got a ticket for the doll shop where she took Bunny's doll to be repaired.
If the ticket and the doll is real, then they'll have to believe that Bunny is real.
Proof. She runs to the doll shop to retrieve the doll, but when she shows it to Stephen, he knocks her out and burns the doll, then rushes her to the hospital, telling the staff that she's been hallucinating that she has a daughter.
She kept going on and on about an imaginary child she thought was lost or something. Perhaps I have to consult a psychiatrist.
Meanwhile, Newhouse is investigating the shipping receipt that has the passenger manifest on it to see if Bunny existed. And oh no, he's actually found something interesting. Anne escapes from the hospital and hurries home to find Stephen burying all of Bunny's things and pulling her from the trunk of his car. Stephen feels his relationship with Anne has become estranged because Bunny has come between them.
You did wrong, Annie. You forgot about me. All you could think of was that boy. That dirty, rotten boy. That was wrong, wasn't it?
Yes, Stephen. It was very wrong.
And then you let her grow inside you. You didn't have to do that. But you did. Now we can't be together anymore. She's always there between us.
Anne begins to play childhood games with Stephen to distract him. At one point, she tries to hide Bunny in the solarium, only to find that Stephen is locked inside with her. It seems she can't win, until she asks her to push him on the swings.
Stevie, come here. I want to go high, Stevie, and I can't go high without you. Come here.
He indulges her long enough for Newhouse to arrive and arrest Stephen, having lied to Newhouse about the shipping receipt to cover up his crimes. So, it's a movie that definitely shows its hand faster than most mysteries do, I think. But, I mean, we'll get into this. I should mention that because the research is limited for interviews from Preminger or from Kira Lindley or Kira DeLay, I did have to use a lot of information from the commentary Blu-ray, the U.S. version. The U.K. version actually has some more interviews on it with Kira Lindley and some other folks. But I don't have a UK version or an all regions player. So any kind of quotes that you hear, just assume that they are coming from a combination of Julie Kurgo, Lem Dobbs, and Nick Redman, if I don't specify otherwise. So one thing that we should bring up first, because it's the first thing that we see, is the credit sequences.
Yeah, the credits by Saul Bass, who I think did... I mean, I know he did Anatomy of a Murder and probably quite a few other...
Yeah, long-time collaborators.
Movies. Yeah. And they have, like, a little doll that gets cut out, and it's, like, the last image of the film that you see as well. And they're that same... They're kind of classic Saul Bass kind of font and kind of rotoscope... title sequence, and it's great.
Yeah, and there's a hand peeling away, like construction paper to peel away or reveal the names of the cast, and it's something that we should always comment on when it comes to Saul Bass, is he's creating his own kind of film within a film with his credit sequences. Like, this is a short film in itself, and it actually, if you're paying attention, essentially kind of reveals the whole plot of the film. Because you have kind of a man's hand who's doing these childlike things like pulling away. And he's also kind of destroying things at the same time. And you're like, oh, I see this credit sequence. And it makes perfect sense now that I know what this, you know, the caper is about.
Mm-hmm. And then it goes back to it like right at the end of the movie as well.
So, yeah, exactly. Mm-hmm. Is that something I think with indie filmmakers... It's not something where you can hire usually a Saul Bass, you know, to do your credit sequence, or, you know, sometimes you can't indulge yourself in that way. And I'm wondering, do you think about this when you are when you're putting together a film?
Yeah, I mean, when I was in film school, I went to a pretty old fashioned film school that at the time was run by Mike Lee in London. And we used to do all our titles in that way. And I've my mind has gone blank about what the machine is actually called that you do it on. But so we would do them in camera, and we would kind of create these like cardboard things to do our titles with.
Yeah.
And so I think the reference was always the like Soul Bass title sequences that we would look at mm-hmm. when we were doing that. I mean, nowadays it's just, any title sequence I've done, I think, has been digital. For my movie She's Missing, we shot footage particularly for the title sequence. Mm-hmm. And it's the only footage in the movie that's like, it's shot on 35mm and it's a mixture of 35 and 16, and it's from a rodeo, and we shot it before anything else that we shot with the rest of the film. And mm-hmm. it has this kind of Americana quality. And the original title for my film was Highway, which kind of speaks to the kind of thesis of the film. Mm-hmm. And it was renamed She's Missing during the kind of marketing and that sort of thing. So in a way, like, the thing that I was upset about that, because it didn't work so well with the title sequence, because it was designed in a way to have the title Highway appear, and you have roads and rodeo queens, okay. and, you know, all of this kind of American dream, kind of American nightmare stuff. Mm-hmm. And then you have the title, and I would have done it differently in a way. I've grown to really like the title.
It's definitely evocative of Bunny Lake Is Missing,
and in
too.
A way, like, that's how I learned to love it, by thinking of that movie and mm-hmm. sort of going, okay, well, you know, it does what it says on the tin in a way. Yeah. So the title sequence, I think it's like it was written into the script for my movie, and I think it is really nice if either in the first scene or in the title sequence you learn, like, if you're looking really hard, what is going to happen through the movie, and it gives it that kind of thumbprint.
I'm curious too, because you are from Dublin, and you grew up where, in Ireland or in.
I grew up in Ireland. I grew up in the countryside, just south of Dublin, in the Wicklow Mountains.
Because I find it fascinating. There's one thing that there's a writer, Brad Stevens, who was writing about the movies that were made in the mid '60s in London at this time, and he said, this movie is a part of a cycle of films made by foreign directors in London, including there's like Blow Up, Repulsion, Fahrenheit 451. It's fascinating to see how many foreign directors regarded mid-60s London as an appropriate setting for stories about individuals whose perceptions of reality have become unreliable. Lucy with Servant and Accident, Richard Lester's Beatles films, Ferry's Ypcrest File, Aldrich's Killing of Sister George, and the list goes on and on. But people came from other places specifically to go to London to tell a story about disconnect and kind of losing one's sense of reality. And so in that sense, like, London, okay, that's the story you can tell there. You, coming from Dublin, being raised overseas, and then, you know, now living here in Los Angeles, you come to the American West and you tell a story about, you know, identity and losing of self and that kind of thing. So I'm curious about what that means in the larger scheme of things.
I think that's really interesting. I think it's because, you know, London at that point in the 60s was so iconic, and, you know, people were coming from all over the world to go there. And I think, and America has that as well in a way. And I think there's a tradition of European directors making those movies in America, specifically in the American West landscape mm-hmm. as well. I think it's not so much about identity, but it is about finding yourself in a landscape or loneliness mm-hmm. and searching. And, you know, there's films like Paris, Texas, Zabriskie Point. More recent films, not so much in the West, but like, we need to talk about Kevin. Like, I think these mm-hmm. these movies made by European directors in America as well, that there is, and I hope that She's Missing, like, sort of, you know, fits into a tradition of that, because it's not, these movies and She's Missing are not set in, they're not entirely set in a reality or in a real America. They're in an idea of that. Because I think when you come to America, I mean, when I moved to California, right when I was writing this script, and I started going out to the desert and that kind of thing, it really was, I had never seen anything like it. And I think that when you get filmmakers and they see that, it they want to make a movie about it, and the desert and all that kind of thing is so inspiring in a way, because it seems like another planet.
We're going to take a quick break. When we come back, we're going to talk a little bit about some of the things that you brought up, including the kind of idea that they're all in cages, and that Preminger style of frame within a frame. So we'll take a quick break and we'll come right back.
Nearly two decades ago, Commander Data sacrificed his life.
The Greatest Discovery is also about Star Trek Picard.
Jesse Thorne won't let us stay on the network unless we do all the Star Trek series, and so here we are, doing a show about maybe our favorite Star Trek character of all time.
If you're excited to watch the new Star Trek Picard series and you'd like some veteran Star Trek podcasters to watch it along with, we're your guys. Sorry you're stuck with us.
What the hell are you doing out here, Picard? Saving the galaxy.
So subscribe to The Greatest Discovery. You can find it anywhere you find podcasts.
Or at MaximumFun.org.
Welcome back to Switchblade Sisters. I'm April Wolf, and I'm joined today by Alexandra McGinnis, and we're talking about Bunny Lake is Missing. So you had mentioned the zombies. You brought that up, and I wanted to make sure that we said that the it was the very first promotional tie-in. The very first, like, the most prominent one, too, of movie music promotionals. And Preminger apparently raised more money for the movie than he ever could have by making this deal with the zombies. And Julie Kerrigan et al. Said he thought it would make the movie more with it, more swinging. They get top billing on the movie posters as though they're one of the stars. There are three zombie songs. All are okay, but they don't use She's Not There.
Yeah. I didn't think about that. Yeah.
I thought that was fascinating in terms of, I mean,
I suppose they're trying to promote their new single. I didn't realize that it was a promotional tie-in. But
yeah. Apparently, I mean, like, they got top billing.
Yeah.
Which was something that I was unaware of. You know, one would assume that the zombies sharing top billing with, like, Laurence Olivier would maybe not be normal, but...
Yeah, I mean, I remember seeing this and thinking it was really cool whenever I saw this movie first. And my first film had, I think it was almost maybe from this movie, but it had these live performances of bands in... The movie is set over like a series of four or five parties, and at kind of every party there was a band and everyone would dance, and it would just, like, there would be these scenes. So we found these, like, four or five bands that were in London at the time, and we would kind of just stop what was going on in the storytelling of the movie to have these bands play, and they would play to track, and it was really fun to shoot because everyone would just kind of, we'd have a few cameras and they would, so I mean, I always liked the fact that there was, like, this long band playing on a TV in a pub in this movie. I thought it, like, really added to the atmosphere of it and that kind of thing.
Preminger, as far as I know, I don't think that he worked ever with the same composer. He was always working with different composers. And perhaps that's something that you're feeling, too, where there's something new or exciting about working with sound in a different way with someone new.
Yeah, I mean, it's one of my favorite parts of the process of making a film is the music and especially the sound design, where you're just creating this whole sonic world for the film as well. And, like, you know, with this film, I worked with a composer and also a sound designer, and we did all the post-production in Ireland because of the funding. And the sound designer, you know, he gave each of the characters, Lucy Fry and Aza Gonzalez, like sound cues that you are kind of imperceptible, but, you know, whenever Jane is there, there's a kind of jangling, or like there's like she's has jewelry or stuff in her pockets or that kind of thing. And it's just there. And I mean, I'm trying to remember what Lucy's cues are, but there was some like kind of hoarse noises as well, which he kind of added in for her. And I think that, you know, when in the time when this movie was made, just people spent so long working on sound, and it's something that doesn't get enough attention put into it.
It was very, very much part of the art form, in the same way that a lot of these directors actually avoided working with editors. At this time, Preminger was probably the most egregious abuser of not working with editors, because he did everything kind of cutting in camera. So we should probably talk about Preminger's long takes. Here's a quote. These famous long extended takes where everything is done in one shot, where the camera pans with characters. That's Preminger. Two classic forms of filmmaking are montage, the story told through juxtaposition, i.e. editing, and then there's composition and framing, which Otto Preminger relied upon. The reason cinephiles love him so much is that he told the story visually and completely in the frame. It didn't matter the stories lacked a little, unless they were just terrible, and then you noticed it.
Yeah, I mean, that is right, I suppose. It is. It's these kind of, I suppose, moving and panning with cranes and characters kind of like, you know, heavily blocked in his style. And I mean, there's another example of this in one of his, I think the films of his that I really like are maybe the less popular ones. Mm-hmm. Like, I'm not such a big fan of Man with a Golden Arm and Anatomy of a Murder, but I really like this movie, Bunny Lake, and Daisy Kenyon, and Laura, and his version of Bonjour Tristesse, which starts with Gene Seberg. And it starts in black and white, and then it goes to color, but it has this kind of wonderful scene through a party, and she's kind of this beautiful, depressed girl at a party in Paris, and I think it follows her like out of a sports car and down a corridor and into a party, and I think, I mean, in my memory, especially in the opening of his films, it's these kind of long shots that that don't cut. Maybe it is throughout as well. At the end of this movie, though, it gets quite cutty, though. There's like a scene where there's this weird brother and sister relationship that is central to the movie. The brother, Stevie, is pushing her on a swing, and they're kind of yelling at each other, kind of higher and higher. And that, as far as I can remember, is that there's like a lot of quick cutting around that time.
Yeah, that, I mean, that's when the narrative kind of breaks in the same way that the visual aesthetic breaks. So I think, you know, thematically, I thought that was really interesting. The cutting in those scenes, it was really, I think, evocative of even like Elia Kazan, who is, you know, does really amazing editing in some of his films, where it's just, you know, very jarring, but it tells this really dynamic story, and you kind of get that sense towards the end. But most of it, yeah, it's just these long, fluid takes where power dynamics are revealed by one person walking, you know, closer to the camera, the other one fading into the background, and maybe a person walking in front of a frame or walking in front of a window, and, you know, things, partitions separating people, even though they're in the same frame. And that, to me, I found very interesting. So Preminger, when he was interviewed about this film, he said that his message, if there is one to be taken away, is that nonconformists, like an unmarried mother, cannot rely on law and order. If you're a nonconformist, bad things will happen to you, and there will be nobody there to protect you.
Right.
Which is, I mean, it's interesting because the film ultimately ends up kind of proving that point wrong, because you have this very traditional and staid force with the Laurence Olivier, who's as the comment track said, is the kind of fulcrum of sanity in this, where it's just like, we're just getting the facts, ma'am, you know, that kind of thing. But I find that interesting, where it's just, it is simultaneously what he wants to have as a comment of like this unmarried woman who didn't want to be married. And, you know, she's in this new place by herself and she is trapped.
Mm-hmm.
It's like curiosity is the problem. Wanting to go off on your own, it's all the problem. And yeah.
But she, what is, I think, interesting as well is that she comes up with this bizarre game that she plays with her brother at the end in order to stop him killing her daughter, I suppose. But I suppose she's ultimately saved by Laurence Olivier. But in a way, that's sort of after the fact. Like, she's already come up with this way of stopping it.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, I think, yeah, I mean, with my film as well, I mean, one of the ideas that I wanted to have going through the whole movie was that there's this woman on her own in the desert, and when her friend goes missing, she's even more on her own, and that in a way, the landscape and the men around her and this kind of thing, like she does run into all these sort of dangerous situations and these people who may seem like they're going to help her, but they're not.
Mm-hmm.
And that was certainly one of the feelings that I had when I came to America and I was on my own, was that you could just drop off and mm-hmm. no one would notice or that kind of thing, because, and maybe that was the feeling in London at that time as well, that you mm-hmm. could just get swallowed up.
There's also the irony that no one really even listened to Anne in this movie until her brother showed up. So yeah. If her brother's taken away, like she's, even though her daughter is safe, she's even more alone and less in control mm-hmm. without him.
I mean, it's interesting, though, because at a certain point, I mean, he always seems weird, the brother.
Yeah.
He seems, like, psychotic in a way at the beginning. But at a certain point, he, like, goes just completely crazy. And but it seems like she's expecting this, you know? Like, she knows that he has this in him, and she knows exactly what to do when his kind of plans are revealed and it's revealed that he has her daughter in the trunk of his car.
Yeah.
Which, I mean, I watched this with my husband the other day again, and he didn't know what was going on. Like, at a certain point, he was really surprised when Bunny was in the trunk of the car. I mean, I thought that it was kind of easy to see that that was coming, or, you know, that they were really kind of laying it on a bit thick with mm-hmm. the kind of creepiness of the brother. But he was like, oh, my God. and he was convinced during kind of the second act of the movie that Bunny didn't exist.
We're going to take another quick break. When we come back, I would like to get a little bit more into Keira DeLay's performance, because I think that we can hit on a few things about why it might work for some people, why it gives it away, why it hides it, all that mm-hmm. kind of stuff. So we'll do that. And that's also kind of talking about the idea of working with inexperienced actors, because he was an inexperienced actor, as was Carol Lindley at that time. So we're going to take a quick break and we'll be right back.
Welcome back to Fireside Chat on KMAX. With me in studio to take your calls is the dopest duo on the West Coast, Oliver Wong and Morgan Rhodes. Go ahead, caller.
Hey, I'm looking for a music podcast that's insightful and thoughtful, but like also helps me discover artists and albums that I've never heard of.
Yeah, man. Sounds like you need to listen to Heat Rocks. Every week, myself, and I'm Morgan Rhodes, and my co-host here, Oliver Wong, talk to influential guests about a canonical album that has changed their lives.
Guests like Moby, Open Mike Eagle, talk about albums by Prince, Joni Mitchell, and so much more.
Yo, what's that show called again?
Heat Rocks, deep dives into hot records.
Every Thursday on Maximum Fun.
Mm-hmm. Welcome back to Switchblade Sisters. I'm April Wolf, and I'm joined today by Alexandra McGinnis, and we're talking about Bunny Lake is Missing. So before we left, we talked about Kira D'Elia and how it might not have worked for your for you, but did work for your husband, the misdirection of him. But I would love to talk about the fact that Kira had been in a movie called David and Lisa previously to this, and he is a kind of psychotic character in David and Lisa, and he is remarkably similar to his character here. And for a lot of people who were watching the movie at the time, who had seen David and Lisa, it was a tip-off immediately, because mm-hmm. they're like, oh, here comes that guy who's acting the same way. He's obviously going to have a psychotic break. Like, that's going to be him. And so Preminger had actually seen David and Lisa, and, you know, he could obviously play this part, so he brought him on. But something about the context of him starring in this movie so close after this other kind of big break for him just already tipped off the audience, and they had a hard time believing him as a normal person. So they assumed, you know, they already got it.
I mean, he gets away with the amount of affection that he has to give his sister in a way, and it's only a few scenes in where you start thinking, he just kisses his sister an awful lot.
Yeah, because, like, you have to kind of back it up and be like, wait, are they married? Because I for, you know, like, the first couple of times that I watched it, I kept forgetting.
Yeah, it's a reveal that they're brother and sister.
Exactly, yeah. So, I mean, it's certainly, I mean, Preminger is pushing on those taboos, as he was wont to do.
Yeah.
Was definitely pushing on those. And Kier is kind of the right strange personality to potentially mm-hmm. pull that off.
Yeah, and I mean, Carolyn Lee, she looks like a kind of victim as well, in that kind of way that women were cast at that certain point. So,
mm-hmm. you know, to go on, Kier was a little bit less experienced, although I should say that even though he looks quite young in this film, the portion of 2001 A Space Odyssey that he was in, he filmed his part only a few months after this movie was released. So it was actually quite short period of time. And as Alexandra and I were talking about at the break, it seems to be that there's an assumption that Kubrick had seen his role in this movie, which maybe gave him the part opposite Hal. but I wanted to talk about inexperienced actors. The commentary track had said, Olivier went to Preminger at one point and said, "Dear boy, please don't scream at the children," which says as much about Olivier's attitude towards these two as Preminger's. They were young and inexperienced. Blank slates, you can argue it works with this film. Was Preminger deliberately casting actors who were slightly inadequate to get an effect? Are they out of their league because they're meant to be a weird incestuous couple? Is she supposed to be as nuts as he is? And is that deliberate on the part of the filmmakers? With Preminger, you don't know if it's because it's purposeful or because he's being lazy. So, I mean, how do you feel about working with inexperienced actors?
I really like it. On my first film, there was it was a big cast. There was kind of 11 central characters, and a lot of them, it was their first film. Some of them had gone to drama school and some of them didn't have any experience.
Mm-hmm.
And that film, I like to work with at least two cameras in a way, so that you can, like, have one camera on each person if you're in a scene with two people, mm-hmm. and then sometimes a third camera to pick up, like, details that are going on, just like cutaways.
I mean, that seems like a lot of work.
But you do the scene like two or three times and you've done it.
And you're done.
You have all of the coverage. But I think it works well for inexperienced actors, because you can capture their moments in when you're getting the coverage on the mm-hmm. other person. And I like to talk to the actors when I'm working with them, suggest other things for them to say, kind of, I think, and with more inexperienced actors, that can be helpful, because you're there helping them through the scene and that kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, on this film, everyone was pretty experienced, you know. It was, there's a child in the movie, and she was a total pro, and that kind of thing. In fact, she kept giving out to Josh Hartnett and saying, "You don't know your lines," which was kind of, I think he found quite difficult.
It's like, are you serious? He was in Halloween H2O. Come on.
I do remember she'd come up with, like, you know, she's like this six-year-old actress in New Mexico, and she'd come up with all this, like, business that she was going to do in a scene with him that didn't actually make it into the cut. But she was kind of banging stuff with a stapler and kind of drawing stuff, and she was doing the same thing every take. But he found it really distracting and couldn't hack. And he kept, like, kind of just, like, stopping her doing it and this kind of thing. It's harder to work with real people in America because everyone, you know, I mean, it's SAG is great and all that kind of thing, but it's harder to, like, get people into the unions and get them to work. I think in London, when I was working before, like, if you saw someone on the street, you could kind of bring them in and they could be in the film.
Yeah, that's my person.
Okay. Yeah.
I wanted to talk a little bit about this movie being an adaptation and some of the writers, because the writers, Penelope Mortimer, was actually brought on first. Here's the quote from the story. Penelope had no patience for the movies, but was originally hired to write the script for this movie. Preminger tried for years to make this film. He first hired Ira Levin, who then became the author of Rosemary's Baby, and also wrote The Stepford Wives. His script did not please Otto. Then he tried Dalton Trumbo. It wasn't until Penelope came along that he felt he could make it. She came up with the crucial idea that it's the brother. The brother is the villain of the piece. In the book, it was a former mistress of the school, a quote-unquote menopausal maniac. So it wasn't until the story became about perverse sex, incest, that he felt he could make this movie. Which is very Preminger.
Yeah, I mean, it seems much less interesting to have it be the headmistress.
Yeah.
I mean, I suppose it's the woman who's recording the children's
Ada Ford,
night.
Yeah.
Yeah. And then Penelope Mortimer got her husband involved, I suppose? Or?
Yeah, yeah. The quote is, this is from Penelope Mortimer. Even when I was back at my familiar desk, I couldn't write the script. I've always been paralyzed by when confronting fiction. Who are these people? How do they brush their teeth? I have no idea. Plots are consequences of behavior, and I have no idea how to impose one on characters I don't know. John Mortimer, however, could do it with ease. Otto agreed to my suggestion we should collaborate, and we were summoned to Hawaii, where he was shooting the bombing of Pearl Harbor in harm's way. We hung about for 3 days in explosions that shook the hotel and smothered the palm trees in dust, and during a brief truce, Otto and John discussed the possibilities of losing a five-year-old in Hampstead. The whole thing had become so unreal that I went to sleep with my eyes open, waking with a start to murmur what I hoped were appropriate comments. So John and Penelope, very fascinating couple. They were only married for a short while. John Mortimer had another wife named Penelope before her, too.
Oh.
Very strange. But there's, you know, these characters who have, you know, missing pieces to them. And John Mortimer often wrote of characters who were missing. Mm-hmm. Something that wasn't quite there. Absent parents, people that you never see or never meet, but you're always talking about them. And I found that really fascinating. It was just like perhaps that was an unacknowledged obsession for him, even though this is a kind of like work for hire thing that you put yourself into it. Even if it's quote unquote not a personal film, it becomes a personal film.
Yeah,
I wonder if you could maybe speak on that for a second. It's just like you do have to put a piece of yourself into it.
I think people often get tied up when they're talking about films that, like, with my first film, it was about this girl who comes to London and she's kind of lost in this world of parties. And when I premiered the film, everyone was like, and this is about you. Mm-hmm. And this is, you know, you're a young woman who lived in London and that kind of thing. And obviously there's personal elements to the film, but it's not, you know, it's not like I made a biopic, and the same with this movie. But there's, and I think that happens, especially with women, that they're just like, well, every film is autobiographical, and it is, but it's not so literal. But there was, you know, in this film, I think, you know, there are things that you don't even think are personal that become personal at a certain point during the making of a film. And it might, I realized when I was in the middle of making this film that it was really about this type of friendship that that girls have and that I had experienced when I was younger, where where the friendship is the most important thing to you, and you're in this power struggle, and you can't lose your friend because it's your life when you're a teenager, like often like your best friend or that kind of thing.
Yeah.
And it was sort of about that period of time in your life. Well, maybe you have to leave that friendship and go and search for other things in your life, and hopefully the friendship evolves or you make other friends. And then in this film, that doesn't happen. It's kind of like what happens if the friendship ends up kind of destroying you in a way.
Out.
Yeah. But I didn't even realize that till I was shooting the film that it was like about these sort of like, you know, like friendships I had when I was like 12 or something.
Yeah.
I was like, no, you know, when I started making it, I was like, no, it's about this and this and this. And then you're like, no. Okay. I have to like make sure I'm doing that when you're telling it.
Oh man, I would love to hear an Otto Preminger tell us what parts of himself he put into this movie. So that's it for our show today. Thank you so much for coming in and talking about this film, which I love.
Thank you, April.
And people, again, they can see She's Missing on VOD, iTunes, right? And
iTunes, Amazon, Vudu, all sorts of streaming places. It's available now.
Wonderful. Thank you so much for coming on.
Thank you, April.
Thank you for listening to Switchblade Sisters. If you like what you're hearing, please leave us a 5-star review on Apple Podcasts. If you do, we'll read it on air. If you want to let us know what you think of the show, you can tweet at us at Switchblade Pod or email us at SwitchbladeSisters@MaximumFun.org. Please check out our Facebook group. That's facebook.com/groups/SwitchbladeSisters. Our producer is Casey O'Brien. Our senior producer is Laura Swisher. And this is a production of MaximumFun.org.
I have all their little nightmares on my tape machine.
MaximumFun.org.
Comedy and culture.
Artist owned.
Audience supported.